This is Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. These days, when we think of the term hive mind, it tends to conjure up internet-related images. Well, my next guest studies some of the original hive minds. I'm talking about honeybees, social insects. Tom Seeley is Horace White Professor in Biology in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University. He's the author of multiple books about bees, including The Wisdom of the Hive, Honeybee Democracy, and most recently, Following the Wild Bees, The Craft and Science of Bee Hunting. He recently joined me for a conversation in our Woods Hole studio. Tom, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here, Heather.
All right. You first encountered beekeeping, I understand, when you were in third grade. And it's a fascination that has carried you now through a long and successful career. What was it that struck you as what an 8 or 9 year old and so fascinated you about bees?
A couple of things fascinated me. One was the amazing flavor of the honey.
I know firsthand from taking comb to classrooms that also just the joy of being able to stick your finger through the honeycomb and then lick off the honey is irresistible to elementary school students.
Yeah, the neuroscience of it is that response that we have to sugar, but especially honey, is the most rewarding stimulus that the human brain ever processes. So it worked well for me. But I think even more importantly for me was the beekeeper brought in what's called a movable frame hive, a Langstroth modern hive. And he showed us the combs, and it was just so elegant. It was that beauty, the beauty of the design of a beehive.
You know, you were just talking about how fascinating you find the beehives that we use for domesticated bees and beekeeping, but you're also known as an expert at finding wild bee colonies. The first bees that you kept were actually wild bees, that a swarm that you captured. And bee hunting is the subject of your most recent book. Can you just tell us how you actually, it's called bee lining, right?
Right.
How do you find these elusive bees out in the wild?
You go and capture some flowers, some bees off of flowers where they're just doing their normal thing. You introduce them to a small piece of natural bee comb that you've filled with sugar syrup. You use a little box called a bee box, bee hunter's bee box, to do that efficiently, that introduction. You introduce the bees to this irresistible food source. Those bees then load up on your sugar syrup. They fly home. They come back, and often they will do, when they're at home, they'll have done some of their waggle dances to recruit nestmates to your food source. And in a half an hour or so, you've got thus a traffic of bees between your little food source out in a meadow, wherever you have started your bee hunt, and the bees home out in the woods or whatever. And then it's a matter of carefully observing the direction that the bees are coming and going from your little feeder and timing those bees. And thus you can learn the direction and distance to the bee's home. And that could be 100 meters away, or it could be a mile away. And then step by step, you move your little food source along with your bees back towards their home. And so it's a way of following the line. And that's why I call my book Following the Bees. You're following them back to their home.
I'm talking with honeybee expert Tom Seeley of Cornell University. Tom, I'm curious, these wild bees that you can find out in the forest, we've heard so much in recent years about the decline of bees being kept professionally or by amateurs, the domestic bees. What about these wild bees? Are they suffering the same declines? Are they struggling in the same way that domesticated bees are?
Yeah, just to frame that a little bit more, the species Apis mellifera that consists of two groups of bees here in New York and New England. There are the bees that are managed by beekeepers, but then there's a whole other group of bees that are living out in the wild, in houses or hollow trees, just wherever that aren't beekeepers' hives. There's genetic flow between those two populations, but they live very different lifestyles. And the ones that are living out in the woods, to answer your question, remarkably, they are thriving in the same places where the colonies that are managed by beekeepers are having more difficulties. That difference in how the wild colonies are able to thrive is the subject of my focus of my research these days.
So let's talk about one of the things that the domestic bees are really struggling with, which is this parasite called the varroa mite. I mean, it's almost impossible to find a colony that doesn't have varroa mites at this point. What about out in the wild? What are some of the coping strategies that they have for somehow surviving with this mite that was introduced, what, about 25, 30 years ago and has really been such a problem for beekeepers?
Yes, the bees living in the wild do have the mite. As you say, virtually every honeybee colony in the United States has the varroa mite these days. How are the wild colonies dealing with that? Why are they thriving even though they're getting no attention the way the managed colonies are? Managed colonies, those kept by beekeepers, receive mite control treatments. These mites are a parasitic mite. They're native to a species of honeybee that lives in Asia, and they spread viruses that are actually what kill the bees. But anyhow, the bees out in the wild, they have two general things going for them, Heather. One is that they've undergone very strong selection for traits that enable them to deal with the mites. And these are things like the ability to chew up the mites and kill them and inhibit their reproduction. And they also have several other things that are going for them that don't have to do with their genetics, but have to do with their lifestyle. In contrast to the managed colonies, the colonies living in the woods are very small colonies, so they don't offer the bonanza resources to the mites that the managed colonies do. Beekeepers artificially manage their colonies to be very large and very productive of honey. But out in the wild, the bees they live in small groups. They don't need to make lots of honey, and so they don't offer as much opportunity for the mites to reproduce. And those mites that do reproduce get hammered by the bees.
Are there lessons that we can take from those wild bees, what they're doing and what they have in terms of genetics, perhaps, and apply that to managed bees to try to maybe with less of the treatments or simply just increase the success rate of managed colonies?
Oh, yes. Learning from these wild colonies on how to be a different kind of beekeeper is probably one of the most important things we can learn these days from these wild bees. It's what we call Darwinian beekeeping. It's a form of beekeeping where the beekeeper aspires to make less honey from the colonies, from each colony, but has healthier colonies. And this will involve managing the colonies so they live in a small hive, so that they can live in a more modest manner, store up less honey, go through a process called swarming, which is actually is a means whereby a colony sheds a lot of its mites. It creates a period when a colony swarms, or in other words, divides itself with the mother queen leaving with about two-thirds of the worker bees to set up a new nest, and a new queen takes over in the old nest. When that happens, it creates a break in the brood in a honeybee colony, the production of the eggs and the larvae and the pupae. And that means that there's a period of time in there when the mites can't reproduce. In fact, the mites can't hide in the brood cells, and thus they're exposed to the grooming activity of the honeybee. So one can have colonies without even having to treat them for mites by letting the bees take care of it themselves.
My guest is honeybee expert Tom Seeley of Cornell University. I wonder if years of observing these honeybee societies and living in human society, if you have any insights. I mean, this kind of collective intelligence is something that I think we aspire to. And we live in a democracy where theoretically that's what we're trying to do, is take advantage of all of the different experiences and expertises that people have and translate that into a better society. Any insights on where we as humans tend to break down in that process?
Oh, great question. I think one of the things where we humans break down is that the nature of our society is very different from the bees or ants and the other social insects, where it's a family group. And the members of a bee colony, for example, they're all in one boat together. It's all sink or swim together. If the colony dies, everybody fails genetically. They're aligned to help their queen, their mother queen, survive and reproduce. In our societies, individuals don't have that beautiful alignment of genetic or whatever you want to call it, self-interest. But that said, there are many situations, especially in smaller human groups, where individuals do see themselves as a member of a group where each individual will benefit if their group does well. These would be things like members of a fire department or some other kind of team situation. And in that situation, whenever individuals, humans, see themselves as with alignment of interest, then they can start to really take advantage of our amazing abilities to communicate, share information, discuss, i.e. process the information, and identify the best options.
Tom Seely is the Horace White Professor of Biology in the Department of Neurobiology and Behavior at Cornell University. He studies the behavior of honeybees. Tom, thanks so much.
You're welcome, Heather. My pleasure.
Living Lab Radio continues after a short break.